And welcome to the first solo podcast. We will keep Sly's office very busy. If you had not heard the news, I will no longer be doing my afternoon program on WBGR out of Monroe. So now we will feed you a steady stream of podcasts with the people that you've heard from over the last number of years. And really, for a very long time, our podcast downloads have only been growing. So let your friends know that they can still catch all the conversations. Joining us now from the Capital Times and the Nation, it's Brother John Nichols. Brother, good afternoon.
Brother, it's a pleasure to be with you. Sly's office is open.
Sly's office is open and eternal.
Good.
All right, so we have an interesting thing that happened yesterday. Reince Priebus was named the White House Chief of Staff. But that was second on the line. Steve Bannon from Breitbart was listed as number one, as being the political advisor. Now, this would put him in the likes of Karl Rove or David Axelrod. Tell us what that position does.
Well, that's the key to the matter, how you described it. It puts him in the position of Karl Rove or David Axelrod. Now, when David Axelrod was there under President Obama or in the Obama era, it was a pretty well-defined political role that was, I think, less definitional in many senses, certainly important, but less definitional. But would you suggest that Karl Rove wasn't a definitional figure in particularly the early Bush White House?
He is still a definitional figure.
Yeah. So that's, you see, the role is defined by the president. It's who the president decides to talk to and, you know, how one is elevated. It's notable that, that in the press release on this, Bannon's name came first. Things like that are thought about by political figures. So we should understand kind of what's going on here. And I will suggest to you, I think NPR, National Public Radio, sort of inadvertently told us a lot about what's going on here when it said that Priebus, a Wisconsinite, is expected to be the liaison to Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and people on Capitol Hill, where Bannon is expected to be the liaison to other parts of the Trump coalition. And you can fill in the blank on those other parts.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that Donald Trump thrives on confrontation? In other words, is he going to enjoy watching the yin and the yang?
Did you ever watch The Apprentice?
You know, I tried not to.
It wasn't that bad. It was kind of interesting at times. But, no, of course, I mean, literally, Trump defined himself as the arbiter, the decider, in a room full of people who were ardently trying to gain his favor, right? To be the person that he, you know, tapped on the head and said, I'm with you. And so I definitely think this is how Trump plans to manage his presidency. You come in, you have different arguments. I think he'll let them argue at the table, as you saw, at least to some extent in the Apprentice, which, by the way, I think we probably undercovered as a model for the Trump presidency. But then at the end of the day, what's interesting, and we don't know this for sure, we know he's driven by a trust/paranoia, right? If you're with him, he really likes you. If you're not, boy, he's ready to slash at you almost immediately. And so we know that those he trusts the most, it appears, I should say we think, is his kids. So what becomes interesting is the question of whether Bannon and Priebus and, you know, all the other characters like, you know, Newt Gingrich and Rudy Giuliani and Kellyanne Conway, all these people, you know, they all come in and kind of make their case and it's really rip-roaring and stuff like that. They walk out. And then do you get a scene like the scene at, you know, toward the end of The Apprentice where Trump sits in the room with his most trusted advisors and kind of talks gossipy about all the people that were just there, and they eventually sort it out. And I'm not kidding about this. I wonder whether it will be with his daughter, son-in-law, and some of those folks.
Well, This is incredible. Evidently, there is no law against him putting his children in the transition team, much less putting the Trump empire in some sort of real blind trust, not the Rube Goldberg thing that he set up. So evidently, he's really not going to play by conventional rules. He's already not playing by conventional rules, talking about his Supreme Court literally taking legislative action to end abortion rights. I couldn't believe that last night. He's talking like the Republicans for years have talked about how, Supreme Court justices shouldn't be legislators. That nuance is gone with Trump.
No, and a lot of it. And there's a great line the other night. Somebody who I think was, not a harsh critic of Trump, was asked about what he was going to do on the Supreme Court. And they said, well, he's got this list of people he might put on the Supreme Court, including Diane Sykes and others. And the analyst said, oh, I doubt he could name the people on that list. So the fact of the matter is, I don't think he's thought more than, a few minutes about the U.S. Supreme Court. Whereas, some candidates for the presidency, including, give her great credit, Hillary Clinton, gave detailed, thoughtful speeches on this issue. And so you're going to end up in a situation where, yes, I think he will see the court as either, a benefit or a problem. He's going to want it to make his way easier. And so I do think his picks become very interesting.
Oh, please. But, I mean, so we've got David Clark, the Fox News sheriff out of Milwaukee, who has described African Americans in the inner city as lazy and unethical. We've got Joe Arpaio, who's under indictment and just lost in a landslide in Arizona, Maricopa County. They're being listed as a Homeland Security advisor.
Well, a president has, this is an interesting thing, Sly. A president has about 4,000 picks to, put into different positions. Some have to be approved by the Senate, some don't. They're not just in the high-profile places we think about, but they're also really the infrastructure of governance, of executive governance. That's, who's going to be on the Federal Communications Commission? Who's going to be,
Sean Hannity?
Trade representative? Well, this is, this is big deal stuff, because these commissions, these agencies have immense power. And to give you a sense of sort of how disconnected Trump is from that, and then we'll go over to Ryan's previous, to give you a sense of how disconnected Trump is from that, just imagine this one, bit from the interview last night. Donald Trump was asked about the fact that he's losing the popular vote, but he's going to become president because of the Electoral College, the ultimate rigged system, right? And he said, I'd prefer it if it was just the popular vote. And, if you got 10 million votes more, then you become president. He didn't even defend the fact that he is going to become president without a popular vote victory. So he kind of lives in this very narrow, self-absorbed world.
No.
And he's going to need somebody, right, who fills all those positions, who kind of extends beyond him. And frankly, I don't think for the most part it will be Bannon. I think Bannon will be more of a message guy. But I will tell you this, as chief of staff, I think Reince Priebus may well be the second most powerful person in America.
You don't think it'll be Mike Pence?
No. Pence, obviously, he's played some role here, and he may have more of a role. But boy, you realize, Sly, again, going back to this guy, Donald Trump, who, kind of doesn't even put the pieces together sometimes, as they use the popular vote, electoral vote, or electoral college thing as an illustration there, doesn't even put the pieces together. He's going to need somebody who can fill all those jobs, who can tap people, identify people for some incredibly powerful positions. And I've got to bet that who has the better Rolodex? Who's got the names of people who could fill those positions, but also somebody who knows, who's ideologically and corporately and Koch brothersly vetted. And that's Priebus.
Boy, Priebus is pretty lucky he lost that state Senate race to Bob Wirch many years ago, huh?
He's taken counsel from the Fitzgerald brothers or something up at the Capitol now. This has turned out real well for him.
He seemed like such a hapless figure all along, caught in the middle. But he must have sent something because, you know, in his heart of hearts, this is not this is not where he wanted to take the Republican Party.
Not what he set out to do.
No, he did the autopsy on the party, and as it turned out, Donald Trump did everything wrong.
According to that autopsy. He ran against the autopsy.
Yeah, he ran against it.
But here's the interesting thing, Scott. Here's the interesting thing. This all comes down to one tweet on one night. I believe it was after the Indiana primary. I hope I'm right. Where everybody else is still the ever-Trumpers who did more to facilitate Trump than any group, I think, in many ways. Because they just were so misguided and so
lame,
you know, trying to do Ted Cruz and stuff like that. But, you know, what did Priebus do on that after, I believe it was Indiana, where it was such a clear win? He said, Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party. It was Priebus, of all the Republican establishment,
right,
that dubbed him as the nominee. And that was critical. That was essentially the death of the Never Trump movement, in any reasonable sense. So it was a big deal guy for him.
John Nichols with us at SlysOffice.com. I want to ask you about the racial divide in America. This sort of bubbled over yesterday on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Mary Matlin, Republican. Van Jones, who has really become a prominent progressive.
And who has spoken out, I think, so powerfully.
Yeah, he's a smart dude. Okay, so this all came bubbling over, the racial tensions, during this conversation yesterday.
I said, and I stand by it, that race was a part, and there was a part, that alt-right part, there was a part of a white lash. And if you listen to the whole quote, you would agree with what I said. So I don't take that back.
I did listen. And Dan, you said, what do I tell the kids? I'm a black man in America who went to Yale, written books, who served a president,
I'm a ninth-generation American, ma'am, and I'm the first one in my family born with all my rights. I'm a ninth-generation American. And so we have not escaped because I went to Yale.
You should
all
not
the
be a racial polemicist. You should be a racial reconciler.
You should be ashamed of yourself to say that to me, to my face. I've spent more time
in
this country.
Would I say it behind your back would be better?
Hold on a second. I've spent more time than you have trying to be a racial reconciler in this country.
Really? How do you know that? Do you know anything about me?
You apparently don't know anything about me.
Yes, I do know. Your daddy, your grandparents were teachers. Your dad, your grandfather was a bishop.
George, this is the problem that we have right now. It is in fact the case that there was a populist revolt in this country, yes, both Sanders and Trump, but one of them was marbled through with this alt-right stuff. If someone like myself, who is married to a white woman, who has spent my entire life building bridges, can't point out the alt-right white lash reaction without being accused of being a racial polemicist, we're going to have a big problem.
And I would say, how do you have no sense of decency to say that? Okay, horrific, brutal campaign.
All right, so Stephanopoulos looked a little uncomfortable, John.
I don't think he was prepared for it. You know, I mean, and I give him credit. These are hard moments, right? I'm not telling you that anybody did it perfectly, but it was an interesting thing what Van Jones did at a certain point. He tried to engage her, and then at a certain point, he turned to George and said, you know, George, this is what happens. He tried to rise above the moment and speak to the challenge. Look, I'm with Van Jones in that conversation. If we start to tell folks in any community that they, because they maybe have done well, that they can't highlight history and contemporary political realities, I can't speak to them in a very realistic, a very informed way, boy, we are shutting down the dialogue. And if there's anything we need at this point, it's an opening up of the dialogue. It's an expanding of it and an acknowledgement of some of what Jones was saying there. You know, he was talking about populist insurgencies of the moment coming from different directions. One of them saying, you know, as Bernie Sanders did, that we need to address these economic issues for all communities, and we also need to respect our immigrant brothers and sisters. We need to respect Muslims. We need to embrace the rights of women. You know, that became a huge part of his speech. Sanders may not have begun perfectly, but by the close of his campaign, you know, he was really kind of pulling it all together there in a very powerful way. Then you have this other thing with Trump, which, while it took elements of economic populism, it interwove them with racism, xenophobia, just all sorts of the kind of darkest, most difficult parts of our history. And, you know, we ought to be talking about all that. We ought to be, you know, we ought to be able to have a deep, nuanced conversation. And I don't think that in that case, Mary Matlin was trying to make that happen. I think she was trying to narrow it in to the sort of Paul Ryan zone of, you know, oh, you know, let's all get together now. Well, no, I don't think there's a lot. I think there's places where maybe people can talk, and I think, you know, again, get together. We'll see. But there's also places where firm lines in the sand have to be drawn, and people have to say, you know, it's just wrong. It's fundamentally wrong to, you know, build some sort of economic argument about demonizing immigrants or people of color or people of a certain religion. And that ought to be called out.
When Donald Trump looked at the camera last night on 60 Minutes and said, knock it off, after Leslie Stahl described some of the incidents, and I don't know if you saw the... Yeah. As we say in Wisconsin, the bubblers at a school where somebody put a sign that said white and then the other one said colored.
It's
beyond comprehension. So as Leslie Stahl described the man living in the bubble in Trump Tower, what's going on in America, and he looked at the camera and said, knock it off. What was your reaction to his reaction?
I think he was probably somewhat serious there. You know, I mean, he's got a big problem. If he wants to present himself as any kind of unifying president of the United States, even in the slightest sense, the movement he built, what he referred to in his last ad as a movement, includes a section of folks, not certainly not the whole of it, but a section of folks who are who have already done things that are absolutely unacceptable. So I don't doubt that he meant it when he said knock it off. However, knock it off, I would suggest to you, is not quite the equivalent of, you know, the great speeches done by political figures in our history to address issues that arise with them and their supporters.
No, okay? It reminded me more of my father driving our Plymouth station wagon, telling us, sitting in the back seat, to behave ourselves.
Or get off our lawn.
Get off the lawn.
But you see, you realize... This is, and it's not to make comparison here, because there's different subtleties of all this, but you think back, oh, you know, there were questions about John Kennedy, the first Catholic to be in a position maybe to be president. Obviously, Al Smith had come before him, but, you know, Kennedy went and spoke, I believe it was to a religious grouping in I think, Houston, or it was definitely in Texas, and he gave this amazing speech. More recently, Mitt Romney gave a speech in which he sought to address his religious tradition. Barack Obama, you know, when there was all the right was stirring up the whole Reverend Wright thing, he gave a remarkable speech in which he, you know, addressed, you know, kind of all these components and stuff. And what I'm saying is that when you've got an issue that has become serious, where people really are saying, you know, where are you at on this thing? How should we deal with this thing? How should we think about this thing? Donald Trump, I mean, if all you can muster is a knock it off, we're not moving the right direction.
Well,
here. That requires a lengthy soliloquy.
Yeah. Well, when you name Steve Bannon your top political advisor, White House counsel, advisor,
political counsel, yeah,
political counsel, I think it gives license to the people who say, yeah, we understand that Donald Trump won the Electoral College, but we have plenty to protest. I'm with them. You know, I'm not with the anarchists busting car windows in Portland, but I am with people that are marching in the streets. And if I get stuck in traffic some afternoon, it probably won't make me happy, but I'll remember plenty of times where we were trying to get attention for workers' rights. By the way, speaking of workers' rights, Grover Norquist put out a tweet thanking Governor Walker and Act 10 for Donald Trump's presidency. And the Huffington Post wasn't quite sure what he meant. Ed Sedlowski from Ask Me was quite sure what he meant. Your reaction to that?
Well, of course. I mean, take a look at the states where Donald Trump won the presidency. He won the presidency in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And if you switch around 54,000 votes in those states, 54,000 Sly, which is, you know, fewer people than you'd put in a stadium for a good football game, right? If you switch 54,000 votes, you switch those states. And so then you ask yourself, well, what were the factors there? There's a lot of factors. So we shouldn't deny that voter suppression, particularly in Wisconsin, changes in voting laws, all sorts of stuff like that, that's a factor. We shouldn't deny the economic issues you and I have talked about. Of course, that's a factor. But boy, Sly, two of those states in the time, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan, in the time since Barack Obama was elected president, went from being some of the strongest union states in the country to right-to-work states. Do you really think that wasn't a factor? Do you really think, you know, right to work in Indiana and other states wasn't a factor? Do you really think the assault on public employees in states across this country wasn't a factor? I mean, it would be absurd to, I mean, that is a part of the overall whole here. And people say, well, yeah, you know, union members or white working class people, they voted, you know, they really shifted. Folks who had been with Obama twice, in some cases, you know, ended up over with Trump. And you say, well, how could that have happened? Well, you know, I think one of the factors is if you dramatically undermine unions, so that people who were union members are no longer union members, so that the ability of unions to communicate with members is dramatically decreased, and the ability to really do a counter message in an effective way is dramatically undermined. Yeah, I think Grover Norquist might be onto something.
John Nichols with us on SlysOffice.com. Fascinating race for the DNC. It appears Keith Ellison is going to announce his candidacy. Howard Dean is announcing his candidacy. Harry Reid has endorsed Keith Ellison. I'm looking who's coming forward after this debacle. And it's Keith Ellison. It's Bernie Sanders. It's Elizabeth Warren. It's Van Jones. And it's Michael Moore. Have I got that right?
Well,
those are the ones that are getting the most attention.
Well, and people who are willing to... Look, here's what we need in this moment, in my opinion. We need folks who are not particularly interested in saying, I told you so. Right? But who everybody knows did try to tell you. Okay? That's an important combination there. You don't have to lord it over folks, but it should be, there should be at least some sense, wow, you know, this is a person who was kind of saying... We got some challenges here, particularly on some economic issues that we ought to be way out front on. Well, the people you've listed, you know, generally are folks that have been there. And then you also need, and this is a tougher thing, you need an optimism. You need a sense of hope and possibility and ability to, you know, take a hit and get back up. And one of the reasons I think that Ellison has emerged and why he has been endorsed or cheered on officially announced it, or he's in the process, I think, but by Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Chuck Schumer, a bit of a surprise, Harry Reid, unions like communication workers and groups like Move On and Democracy for America, although they've got a challenge with the Dean candidacy, but all these folks stepping up and saying, you know, this Ellison thing is really, really interesting, or it's really significant in some cases, endorsing in some cases, simply, you know, speaking up for it. I can tell you exactly what. Keith Ellison's, you know, he's a fun guy. He's got good spirit. He's got good energy.
He's media savvy.
He spoke at BobFest this year, right? And it's interesting that when the attention started to focus on Ellison, he's been working on this for a while, preparing. You know, I think presuming he would be doing it in a Clinton presidency, perhaps chairing DNC during a Clinton presidency, but preparing for this. You know, the first tweet that he sent out after people started to really talk about him, it was a quote from Paul Wellstone about the essentials of building a functional party in times like these. And if you go back and look at the speech it came from, it was, you know, some of it, or at least some of these quotes from Wellstone, and go back to times when the Democratic Party was in a rough place. You know, some of Wellstone made himself as a figure in Minnesota politics in the aftermath of Ronald Reagan's national victory in 1984. And the 1988 victory of Bush, which many people were surprised by, and, you know, carried on that Reagan moment. And what was great about Wellstone was, as tough as the moment may have been, he had this sort of long arc of history vision that said, yeah, we've lost, but we've also won, and we can do this. And Ellison is somebody, people don't know him well enough yet, but they will. Ellison is somebody who was nurtured up, brought, you know, kind of into the political process by Wellstone. Wellstone, a college professor, Ellison, a grassroots lawyer, you know, Wellstone, a guy who's really focused on farm organizing, Ellison, a community organizer, Wellstone, who's Jewish, Ellison, who's Muslim, and yet they came together. The year that Paul Wellstone died was the year that Keith Ellison was elected to the Minnesota State Legislature. And Wellstone talked about Ellison. He talked about, you know, wow, something big is happening here, something good. So, I mean, all I'm and vice versa, of course. And so I think that I don't want to be, I don't want to make this turn into just, you know, emotions and stuff like that. There's deep political components here. But there is, if you're going to go into what looks like a real battle, you want somebody who's, you know, kind of upbeat about it and ready to go. John, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's interest in Ellison.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation, thanks for joining us at SliceOffice.com.
Pleasure, my friend.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.